WGPB News, this is On Second Thought. I'm Celeste Headley. Do you have a passion for vinyl?
First thing I ever did for the Elton John AIDS Foundation was to sell my vinyl. I had so much of it, I didn't know, really know what to do with it, so I sold it. And recently, I started collecting vinyl again, and I play vinyl in Vegas and at home, and everyone releases their albums now on vinyl.
They
and
do,
it's,
yeah.
It's the experience. It's the ritual of looking at the sleeve, getting the album up, putting it on, listening to five tracks, getting up, turning it over. And it sounds so different, I have to say.
LP records are making a comeback in Georgia, and we'll explain why later this hour. But we want you to join that conversation. Does vinyl sound better than digital music to you? Or do you prefer the convenience of an MP3? How do you get your music? Call and tell us at 404-500-9457. You can also post to Facebook or Twitter. It's at OST Talk, and we might feature your comments on the show. In Atlanta, poverty is moving out of the city and into the suburbs. A recent study from Harvard finds the number of high-poverty neighborhoods in the metro area has tripled since 2000. That year, we had about 100 high-poverty suburbs. By 2015, more than 300. I talked about this earlier in the summer with Kim Addy, Senior Director of Health for United Way of Atlanta, also Michael Rich, a professor in the Department of Political Science at Emory University.
Hi, good morning.
Michael, what is considered a high-poverty neighborhood? How do we make that distinction?
Well, typically, people define a high-poverty neighborhood as a census tract with 30% or more of the population living below the poverty line. But some people use other thresholds. Some people might use 20%, some might use 40, but typically it's 30% or higher.
And Kim, why is suburban poverty more complicated than urban poverty, at least in terms of addressing it?
Sure. What we're finding in the suburbs is that there is, in terms of resources, availability of resources, our suburbs are not consistently structured to be able to address the issues that families have in the speed that we see that the urban cities have been able to address. Typically, when we know about poverty in cities, cities are structured to address that. So availability of health services, education services, our federal safety net programs are much more available. In our suburban area, they are much more diffuse, so they're not simply created or put in one specific place where families can access them easily.
Michael, I assume that's because urban centers have a history. I mean, the poverty in urban centers is so longstanding that in many cases, especially political arenas, urban has become sort of an unspoken synonym for poor. So is that what's causing what Kim is talking about, this lack of resources, the fact that this is relatively new?
Well, it's two things. I think one, you're right, traditionally we've thought of the poverty problem as an urban problem, meaning largely an inner city problem, and therefore a variety of public programs, federal in particular, have focused resources to urban communities, to central cities, which in turn have built up the infrastructure over the years to put in place a variety of anti-poverty programs. But it's also been demographic, largely up until the 1980s and into the 1990s. Poverty was predominantly concentrated in central cities. But with the last census, the 2010 census, we see for the first time that there are more Americans in poverty living in the suburbs than in the central cities. The poor have always been in suburbia, we're really only now becoming aware of how concentrated that problem is in terms of the rapid growth. Poverty has been increasing much faster in the suburbs than in the cities, though overall rates are still higher in the cities.
Kim, what do you attribute this to? Are there newer people that were not in poverty, say, pre-Great Recession, who now are? Or are people moving? What's causing the change?
Well, there is a shift that's happening. In the city, there, in terms of the cost to be able to live and rent, those prices are going up. And so it's causing our families not to be able to afford to live in those areas. And so our families are being redistributed in terms of a lack of a better word, into the suburbs because of that. Just affordability, also policy changes. So housing vouchers, you know, the cost really doesn't allow our families to have access to affordable housing. So the inventory of housing that's available, that's affordable, has decreased in our cities. And so our families are looking for stable housing. And so you'll find them moving into the suburbs.
And that complicates things further, Michael. If you're just joining me, I'm speaking with Kim Addy, you just heard, Senior Director of Health for United Way of Atlanta, and Emory Professor Michael Rich. Michael, one reason that causes further problems is because when people have to move further out of the urban center, Metro Atlanta is what is commonly referred to as a transit desert, is it not?
Absolutely. And that's a huge problem, particularly when we look at the distribution of the poor population in Metro Atlanta suburbs. Well, certainly there are large numbers in Clayton and DeKalb counties, which are in tight and have access to MARTA. But you get beyond that, certainly outside the perimeter, access to transit is much weaker and much less available. And so if you're on the edge, you don't have a functioning car, you're often out of luck in terms of your mobility to get to a job.
And Kim, this is not just a Metro Atlanta problem. Across the country, we see this shift of poor moving from, not just moving from the urban areas into the suburbs, but also people in the suburbs who were not poor, say 10 or 15 years ago, dropping below the poverty line. So if it's true that we just don't have the concentration of resources in the suburbs, what needs to happen to fix that?
Yeah, that has to be larger concentrations of partnerships that happen and that cut across regions. So United Way is an example, partners across county and border lines to be able to identify gaps that are happening in terms of services and working much more strategically. Even when you think about funding, just really understanding the needs of families that are happening and understanding how our poor families are very transient, so understanding the underlying issues, but being very strategic about how dollars are redistributed across the region, and also understanding what the barriers are in terms of the systematic barriers of affordability of housing and inventory and things of that nature. So what we're doing is really trying to bridge that gap between services that are available and the families that need them.
Michael, is there political will to address these things? I mean, it would require that, first of all, on a not only a federal level, but on a state level, to understand that this change is happening before the kind of levers of power can begin to move. Is the political will there?
It is in some places. I think we can look back to the mid-2000s. There were about 20 states that actually adopted poverty reduction targets. And they weren't just states on the West Coast and the East Coast. There were a number of states in the South that had legislated poverty reduction targets, formed task forces to look at what kinds of actions could state governments take to promote greater opportunity and help families climb out of poverty. And then the recession hit, and a lot of those plans got stalled in terms of their movement towards implementation. But there's also a lot of control that states have over the federal safety net in terms of things like Medicaid expansion, enactment of a state earned income tax credit to add to the federal earned income tax credit. That's probably the single most important anti-poverty tool we have that helps working families with children rise out of poverty. Other things like healthcare assistance, Medicaid expansion, job training, and the like. So many of the states that are experiencing the most sharpest rise in suburban poverty are states that typically tend to have weaker safety nets.
I want to hear this comment here from Elizabeth Kneebone. She's a fellow at the Brookings Institute, and she's talking about another wrinkle in the suburban poverty problem.
poverty in these kinds of communities can be hidden. It can be harder to identify or even understand the extent to which need has grown because it may not be easily visible.
And so let's hear one other voice. Catherine Aravosis is a single mother in a suburb outside Chicago. Here she is speaking to PBS NewsHour.
It's those days when you get up and you really don't know what you're going to give your kids for dinner. And it can be a full-time job finding out how am I going to get glasses for prescription as a year old? And where am I going to, you know, how do I go and get her the shot she needs? She's going to sixth grade. Not having the health insurance, not having the basic things that people take for granted.
Kim, how difficult is it to identify poverty in the suburbs? And is there a problem with people actually coming forward to ask for help?
Yeah. United Way has developed what we're calling a child well-being index. And within that index, there are about 14 indicators. Out of the indicators, there's a composite score that is assigned to each community. So you have communities like Cobb County or Gwinnett County that has a score around 68% or 61%. What that tells us is that there are areas of high wealth, but there are also pockets of poverty. And so it is hard to identify because you have families that have moved and are transient, are staying in extended stay hotels. So it's hard to identify, but unless you're working with school systems, the homeless liaisons to understand who those children are, because they get on the bus just like anybody else would get on the bus, but you don't necessarily know where they're coming from, right? And you don't understand sometimes the issues that family is necessarily facing. And so having strategic partnerships with school systems and nonprofit partners to identify those families is very essential to helping stabilize families.
We've been talking about suburban poverty in Atlanta, at least in metro Atlanta. The numbers show that many of the poor populations are moving out of the urban area and into the suburbs. Our guests today were Kim Addy, Senior Director of Health for United Way of Atlanta, and you also heard Michael Rich, Professor in the Department of Political Science at Emory University. Kim and Michael, thank you both so much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Just ahead, author Gabrielle Zevin brings her new novel to Atlanta, but first, time to spin some vinyl. It's making a comeback in Georgia. This is On Second Thought. It's On Second Thought. I'm Celeste Headlee. Vinyl records are back in style. You could chalk that up to hipster millennials or maybe the persistence of dedicated audiophiles. But whatever the reason, folks are buying analog music again. KinderCore Vinyl in Athens is the newest and only vinyl pressing plant in Georgia. I spoke with KinderCore President Ryan Lewis back in July.
Hi, how are you doing?
I'm doing well. Thanks for being with us. What does KinderCore mean?
Okay. Well, back in the 90s, around 96, we were in Athens in bands and started a record label, a friend of mine and I, and just to sort of put out our own record and document our friends that were doing stuff. And so we had to come up with a name for it, which in the beginning we weren't taking it very seriously. So we just sort of made up this joke name on just sort of how there were all these subgenres in music that all had core on the end, like, you know, hardcore, emo core, grindcore, whatever. And so we just came up with a silly one because everybody in town referred to us as kids because we were all like 20. So Kindercore was born then, and we ran it as a record label until the early 2000s. And then when we decided to do this, we figured we'd bring it back.
I wonder how closely that sort of parallels the rise of vinyl. I mean, I think that when vinyl started selling again, many people thought as sort of a niche market, and that's turning out to be wider spread than people expected. Is that accurate?
Absolutely. I mean, you can go into Cracker Barrel and buy vinyl now, amazingly. Apparently, they sell it in Whole Foods. I mean, you can get vinyl really... places where you wouldn't have been able to get CDs before. It's sort of incredible how pervasive it's become. And even just noticing it in television, commercials, movies, even like sporting event openings. I think it was like the Super Bowl or something had like turntable visuals, which was sort of amazing to me. But yeah, it's definitely worked its way back into popular culture.
So from your I'm going to read a quote from you, from your press release, and get you to explain it for me. So this says, because of the explosion in vinyl sales, says Ryan Lewis, keeping up with demand without sacrificing quality has been an industry-wide struggle. What do you mean?
Actually, one of the interesting things that happened, I mean, like you were saying about our rise and fall as a label and then return as a vinyl plant sort of does follow the arc of the way the industry changed. But so in that sense, a lot of plants in the early 2000s started downsizing and some of them were closing. So once things turned around and demand for vinyl picked up again, I think a lot of plants were caught off guard by that and they had to spend a lot more energy putting people in production positions instead of quality control and customer service. So unfortunately, over the last decade, customer service and quality control have really gone downhill within the industry, I think, because people have just had a hard time scaling back up and keeping up with it. So that's something that we're really focused on addressing, putting out really high-quality records and having really responsive customer service.
So one of the things that you guys use is what's called a warm tone press.
Yes.
What exactly does that mean? And remember that there are people here that maybe who are hearing this who have maybe never used or even touched a vinyl record.
Sure. Yeah, absolutely. So the process of making records, the actual physical process of melting plastic pellets and squishing them into records, that part of it hasn't changed since the beginning of records. But the what has changed, though, is that for decades there have only been old machines available. So they stopped designing new machines in the late 70s, early 80s. And so all the plants that are out there either have those actual old machines, which is sort of like a Cuba situation where everybody's trying to keep old cars running and you're like buying old machines and taking parts and switching them out with each other. Or they have some newer machines that are basically just the old ones remachined and rebuilt. But the Warm Tone, the thing that we're so excited about is it's a new company in Canada called Viral Technology. And they have developed a new press from the ground up that's fully automated. It has digital sensors to make sure that all the temperature and humidity settings are correct. I mean, basically, it's supposed to make more consistent records faster. And we're really excited about that because it's taking an old end product, you know, an old analog end product, but creating it with the benefit of all the modern digital technology. So it's very exciting.
So to what do you attribute the rise in vinyl record sales? Is it just all those hipsters with the beards and the short hair?
Well, as a hipster with beard and sort of shortish hair, I mean, I wouldn't give myself and my peers all the credit for that. But I think really honestly what happened, at least the way that I saw it, because I worked in record stores for years, is that when digital music became so prevalent and people were, you know, downloading things from iTunes or different stores or just pirating music, there was a while there where people, I feel like, weren't really able to give each other music. You couldn't really gift music as easily. You know, it's not very exciting to buy an iTunes gift card and give it to someone and say, hey, I really dig this record. You should go download it. Because for one, they're probably not going to do that. They're going to go download whatever they want. But it's just not that exciting. And the first time that it really hit me that it was coming back in such a big way was a few Christmases ago when I started to notice that people were buying tons of vinyl as presents. And I would be talking to older people who were like, oh, yeah, all my nieces and nephews just want vinyl for Christmas, blah, blah, blah. And so I think what it is sort of bringing us back to, you know, the importance of having something physical and something that, you know, feels like a very tangible artistic creation in your hands versus having something that you download. It's just more personal. And, you know, the size of the art and everything else, it's just, you know, there's something I think inherently that we got right as a music industry when vinyl was the dominant form, and nothing has really been able to permanently unseat it, because it just sort of is that thing that we love. And, you know, the nice thing about it is that it works really well in conjunction with digital download technology. I mean, personally, I, you know, have a subscription to Apple Music, and I paid $9 a month so that I know what record I want to spend $30 on. You know, I don't want to go out and spend $20, $30 on a record that I haven't heard. So I'll listen to it streaming, find what I like, go out and buy it. I think the two work really well together. So in that sense, I think it's exciting. It's not so much a rejection of the new as it is sort of a combination of the best of both things.
But it also changes the way you listen to music, right? I mean, I had
I had
Thriller on vinyl, and they yeah. had to construct those records so that when you – they had to think about what was the first song you hear when mm-hmm. you flipped the disc over, right? I mean,
absolutely.
Number one, I was more likely to listen to the whole thing mm-hmm. as opposed to shuffling all my selections. But they also had to sort of structure it so that there was an intermission break while you were flipping it over.
Absolutely.
What difference does that make?
Well, and actually it goes even further than that, because there are physical, not so much limitations, but there's just, you know, there are physical demands and physical realities created by a piece of vinyl spinning that affect where you should put certain kinds of songs. So there are things like, you know, a noisier song should come first, and a quieter song should be towards the middle of the record, just because of the way that the physics of the whole operation move. And so that kind of stuff is really exciting as well. So you start to think, oh, well, maybe the reason why this album that I love ends with a really, you know, quiet, slow song on the end of side A is because that's what they were thinking about, you know. And also thinking about the time that records could last. In the 70s, when albums became so much of a bigger thing, you had bands trying to push how long an album could be, and then eventually pushing more and more into double album sets, because there are actually physical limitations about how long a record can be. So in that sense, you combine all those things together, and I think it just gives you a more deliberate album, something that people have spent more time thinking about the intricacies of how it's going to sound in context. And I mean, there's, you know, it's great to get in your car and listen to digital music. It's great to, you know, go for a run or walk the dog or do whatever. But really sitting down at home and putting an album on and listening to it from, you know, beginning to end, both sides, is just something you can't match with digital music. It's just dropping the needle and playing it through and then having to get up and switch it. It's just, it's much more involved. It demands a little more from the listener, I think.
So, Ryan, the trends that we're seeing in terms of purchasing vinyl are often nationwide trends. Is there a market for vinyl in Georgia?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, in really, it's internationally, but yes, absolutely. I mean, if you look at some of the great record stores in Georgia, the Wuxtries and Wax and Facts and places like that, all those places have gone back to stocking mostly vinyl. Most places are doing, you know, some used CDs, but maybe no new CDs. It's really the prevalent way that people are buying music right now.
That is Ryan Lewis. He's the president of Kindercore Vinyl in Athens. Ryan, it's a pleasure. Thank you.
Thank you so much.
You can join the Kindercore guys at Kindercore Vinyl Night tonight at the Georgia Theater rooftop at 11 p.m. Let's take a moment to add a couple more songs to our Georgia playlist. For this, we ask people to pick the best songs from and about Georgia. The rules are simple. All tunes must be written or performed by a Georgian, and artists cannot pick one of their own songs. So today we feature Athens-based indie rock band Future Birds. Guitarist Thomas Johnson offers these picks.
Hi, I'm Thomas Johnson. I play guitar in Future Birds. My first pick for the Georgia playlist is a song called Cocaine Parties by the Star Room Boys.
There's a way that we know we got lucky, the luck to pass. There's a way that we feel when the world is through kicking our ass.
Yeah, it's just a song that we all love. It's, you know, it's a classic love song, but it's also just... there's so much bad country music out there. They're not even telling stories, it seems like, anymore. It's not storytelling or you know, heartbreak. It's just like random things strung together in succession to rhyme. And sometimes they're not even rhyming. You know, it's just like, you know, some chunky guitar and a hell yeah or something like that, you know. But so it was just kind of like a reaffirming, just like, all right, there's still good Southern music being made that is country. You know, that's not necessarily rock and roll. There's tons of great Southern rock out there, but... it's maybe my favorite song of Star Room Boys, so I just figured that was a good one to pick. It's got a ripping solo in it, which is nice too. So.
Oh, but I've been there two times before, yet I'm still around. There's a bittersweet peace in your mind when you're through keeping score.
Dave Marr's voice is very cool. You know, he doesn't get super high or super low in it, but he's just got this super warm voice that just sounds awesome. And the lyrics are quintessential Athens in a way. It's about, you know, a girl who kind of maybe more interested in partying than having a relationship or something. But it's just a song that, that the lyrics hit home, and it just has a nice feel to it.
With your father.
My next pick for the Georgia playlist is a song called Blackout Curtain by Now It's Overhead. Oh man, it's like a kind of starts out with this like offbeat drum part and all these synths coming in, and it kind of has some, you know, big guitar chords and just kind of builds up to this chorus, and then everything cuts out and it's this really pretty vocal melodies saying, "Don't ever go away from me, I won't ever go away," is what it says, and it's just like this really cool kind of yearning, but it's very sincere and like almost it's urgent, you know, it's like a plea.
A gentle, softer song.
At least once, every time we do a big long tour, that song pops up, somebody throws it on a playlist, and it's just one of those, it's just, I consider it a vibey tour song, you know, it's just, the lyrics of that song seem to have a lot of deep meaning, you know, it's a pretty, like, intense song, but yeah, the vibe of the song is super, super cool, and it's got a great melody, and it's just one of those songs that kind of feels like Athens, and kind of reminds me of home, and reminds all of us of home.
Blackout curtain draw.
You know, I think it's just him being a young man, just figuring shit out and trying to sift through the complex you know, the increasingly complex nature of relationships as you get older and older, as, you know, more things come into the fold and there's more things going on in your life and there's less room for what's already there and, you know, more desire for to seek out new things. And I think it's just about, you know, wanting to do both, you know, kind of put yourself out there and become the person that you want to be, but also hold on to the things that are dear to you. There's harsher days,
sunlight. That's Thomas Johnson of the band Future Birds. They perform at the Georgia Theater in Athens tomorrow night at 9 p.m. Just ahead, a new novel that tackles modern misogyny and slut shaming. This is On Second Thought. I will never go away, don't ever go away from here. And I will never go away, don't ever go away from here. It's On Second Thought. I'm Celeste Headlee. As recent events bear witness, women still fight daily for respect in a world that is dominated by white men. Few point to that struggle as well as author Gabrielle Zevin, whose best-selling novel, The Storied Life of A.J. Fikry, really characterized hope and love in a modern world. Her latest novel takes on misogyny and slut-shaming. It's called Young Jane Young. Author Gabrielle Zevin joins me now. Hi, Gabrielle.
Hey, how are you?
I'm doing well. I have to ask first about your novel, The Storied Life of A.J. Fikry, which I just loved.
Oh, thank you.
I mean, that's exactly what people think of when they think of like curling up with a good book. I think that's the kind of book they're thinking of. And I wonder what it's like. I don't want to assume that you didn't know if the book would go bestseller or not, but is it a surprise when a book does really well?
Yeah, I mean, I think if people knew what the secret formula was, then every book would be a bestseller, but every book can't be a bestseller. So I think we were hopeful. I think on some level, you know, we were preaching to the choir because book people liked the book.
Yeah.
You know, so we had a good audience for it. But I mean, I was delighted at how much it connected with people. You know, I think its messages about sort of reading and the joys of going to an independent bookstore and actually turning a paper book was something that resonated with people. But it was really just something I was feeling myself.
And, you know, some research shows that millennials actually are kind of rejecting digital copies of books. So you've kind of plugged into something.
I think they're smart to do that in a way. You know, you can actually have a copy of a book that exists. If you buy something digitally, you don't own it. You just have a license to read it. So it's a very different thing. And also there have been studies in, I think, Sweden and maybe one in the UK also that talked about the fact that when you read in paper, you tend to retain more of what you read than when you read digitally. So I think maybe millennials are on something with that. I know from doing events that my youngest readers, they will buy a book in digital. And if they really love it, they want to also buy it in paper because they want to kind of collect it like a trophy on the wall or something. I mean, well, some of my books I wrote for young people, which I include as books, but I also wrote two novels for adults before Fikry, and one was very political, and the other was sort of feminist. So I think
so.
Maybe
which one should I go to first? Which one would you suggest I check out?
I don't know. It depends. I think I've gotten better as a writer as I've gotten older. I'll say that honestly. You know, so I won't say that I think all of my novels are equally good or anything like that.
Well, one would hope you get better. Otherwise, you're just stagnating, right?
Right. I mean, a book that I was really proud of was this book called The Hole We're In. That was the book that came out before The Storied Life of A.J. Fikry. And it's about a young woman it's about credit card debt and the first generation of female soldiers to serve in combat, which in Iraq, basically. And so but I think the thing is, I've learned more about how to tell an emotional story since that. You know, I had a lot of things I wished to say, but I don't think it necessarily got into a form that, you know, large numbers of people could enjoy. So I think I've become maybe a more sophisticated writer since then. But I do think it's a good book. I do.
So then let's talk about the new one. If you're just joining me, I'm speaking with author Gabrielle Zevin. Her new book is Young Jane Young. So this one is a feminist book.
It is.
Why this book right now?
You know, I think it's important. The, you know, anytime I write a book, I always am trying to tell readers the most important thing I think I could be telling them at the time. You know, and for me, thinking about the fact, I was had incredible anxiety over the last election. I was fascinated by the Bernie Sanders Hillary Clinton primary. And sort of thinking about that, why women have such trouble in politics, why they don't achieve or even seek higher office. You know, we're 51% of the population and we're less than 20% of the seats in the House and in the Senate. And, you know, thinking about the fact that my grandmother, who was born in 1916, was born into a country where she couldn't vote. Some of these issues were things I wanted to talk about in story form.
And it's difficult, isn't it, to talk about almost anything because everything has become political. How did how did you go about writing? I mean, how much did you keep your audience in mind and whether or not they would get offended as you were writing?
I'm not too worried about offending people. I worry more about, I think, giving characters their day in court, so to speak. You know, so I feel like if you've had a character make their case, then how people react to that is not something I can control. And, you know, so I wanted, I think, you know, it's funny, we're in so much of an echo chamber these days where you can kind of just listen to the news that is the news that you already believe. And I think one of the reasons I love fiction is because you still have a chance to talk to somebody who is not like-minded to you. And it's something that fiction can do and stories can do that really news or think pieces cannot. You know, it's funny, like when I wrote the story Life of A.J. Fickrey, my prior book, so many people that wrote me letters, maybe 90% of them said, oh, I'm now definitely going to go visit my local independent bookstore. And I think that's quite interesting because, you know, many of them had surely come across the think pieces that said bookstores were in trouble, or maybe they'd even noticed in their towns that their bookstores had been closing. So I really think that books can kind of do a thing that, you know, news and even physical evidence of something happening cannot. So I think the reason I wanted to tell this story was so that people would have some sort of empathy and really think about the issue of why women do have more difficulty in seeking and attaining higher office.
And it's always difficult to talk about fiction because I don't want to spoil anything for anybody.
You're good.
But I do want to talk about how you addressed all the many different views of what feminism is and the argument that there is over what is feminist and what is not. And some it's kind of brilliant to me the way you deal with the slut shaming, because that's a kind of discrimination that even women engage in.
Yeah, definitely. You know, and somebody recently asked me a question about the difference between sort of shame, which is something we can control. Shame is a feeling we have, and shaming. And I've been thinking that as a woman, I can choose not to participate in a culture that decides to shame other women. I think that's something we can actively do. And yeah, you know, the most important novels to me when I first started reading, I think, serious fiction as a young person were feminist novels. And the older I get, I think it's the more important I think it is for me to be a feminist. And so I wanted to write a book about that. I wanted to write a book that, you know, talked about, you know, what it is we do to young women. You know, an interesting thing, I was listening to an interview on NPR, I think it was Peggy Orenstein who wrote that book, Girls and Sex, and she talked about the fact that I think something like 70% of girls will have taken a naked selfie by the time they graduate from high school. And so if you think about that, are we going to eliminate 70% of girls from seeking public office? You know, we have to start to grapple with sort of the internet and shame and all these kinds of things.
So, I mean, another thing that's really interesting about the way you've fictionalized this argument is, I mean, it's difficult to make entertaining when when any joke you crack could hurt somebody, right? I mean, when you make a joke about something, you have no control over how they take that joke.
That's true.
Yeah.
That's true. I wish I could control exactly how, you know, I want everybody to have exactly the right laugh at any given moment in time. You know, but I also think there's a danger in being too precious about ourselves as women or too precious in culture. I certainly don't want to, you know, hurt anyone's feelings. But I also think me even saying that is a very female thing to say, you know. So I felt like, again, I hope that I've written characters that, you know, that the reader will be able to sympathize with. And if they, you know, laugh along the way, even if they laugh occasionally the wrong laugh, I think we'll all survive it.
I mean, I think that the characters kind of leap off the page, which is what speaks so well that it's almost, I had to keep checking that it was actually fiction, not based on a true story. Yeah. And you were talking about feminist novels that you read growing up. What were they? Because frankly, most of the novels I read growing up were the opposite of feminist.
I think I got really fortunate at my big public school in Florida that the teacher I had was very invested in teaching literature that had women as main characters, you know. And when I say feminist can be as simple as that, just a story about a woman who is the central actor in something. Even books I really love, like The Great Gatsby or many sort of great American novels, women are, you know, side dishes in these books. But so anyway, I had a great English teacher whose reading list included things like Zora Neale Hurston's Their Eyes Were Watching God, The Awakening by Kate Chopin. Trying to think of some others. Song of
Margaret
Solomon,
Atwood,
which isn't.
Maybe?
Yeah, well, no, I mean, I don't think we read too much Margaret Atwood yet, but but that certainly would have, it wouldn't have made
sense. Would have
been
more advanced, yeah.
Yeah.
I think people who are watching The Handmaid's Tale TV series are discovering just how advanced Margaret Atwood is.
Well, I don't know about advanced, but in a way, I think back when I was in high school, like, I think people taught what they perceived to be as genre fiction less. So because that was in a sci-fi universe, I think, you know, you wouldn't have seen that as commonly on a syllabus back then.
But then would you call books where women were the main character, but they were not portrayed particularly strongly, like a Madame Bovary or something? Would you think of that as a feminist novel?
I mean, I think a lot of the books I just named also had female writers, you know, is one of the primary differences. But yes, I mean, it, you know, just to kind of speak to the representation issue, I think it's just useful to read a novel where a woman is a main character if you're a young woman, you know, where you...
Even if
you
it's
think
written
about,
by a guy.
Even if it's written by a man. And if you think about, like, say, how many movies we see where, you know, and they have a male lead, and then television is a little better about this now, but, you know, how many superhero movies we've seen. And I think that's what the power of Wonder Woman was this summer, just finally seeing, you know, that a lady could be the lead in a story. So,
well, she also seriously kicked butt.
She did.
Which was entertaining.
Yes.
You know, if I were had interviewed you about your previous novel, The Storied Life of A.J. Fickrey, I would have asked you whether or not people presume that you're a feminist writer because you're female and you're a successful writer. But now you are a feminist writer because you've written a feminist story. And I wonder if that gave you pause, because critics sometimes treat someone who's quote-unquote feminist than they do any other fiction writer. I mean, look at all the women who write under either use initials so they can't be identified as a female, or they use a male pseudonym.
Yeah, I mean, it's not a concern for me, because again, I've had a kind of long career that's involved lots of kinds of books in it, you know. But I think sort of a related issue is, if you think about even the categories we put women writers in general, you know, like I saw one of the publications had listed Young Jane Young as women's fiction, meaning that, you know, and I think about the term women's fiction, you'll never see a man in women's fiction. And in
and
a
I've
way,
never
what
seen
it does,
a men's fiction department either.
No, exactly. That's just fiction, right? And
yeah.
So in a way, those terms, women's fiction, and it's even like slutty or sister chick lit, you know, are kind of ways of signaling to half the population to not bother reading something at all. You know, so I think that is a real concern. And actually another thing is that when I, you know, obviously Young Jane Young is a book about five five women, four mm-hmm. women, four and a half women.
Yeah.
And, but, you know, The Storied Life of A.J. Fickrey was a book about a man. But, you know, there really aren't men characters in the same way in Young Jane Young. And there was a sort of liberating thing in a way to writing A.J. Fickrey, because he could say things that I think, but that as a woman come off abrasive in a way that people are more find more palatable when coming from a male voice. And another, again, I guess I have a long-winded answer to this, but another thing that happened was after when I put up, I'm not online that much for a variety of reasons, but I put up a synopsis of Young Jane Young when I knew the book was going to be published, and I said that it was a story about, it mentioned the fact that she was a young woman who'd had an affair with an older married man.
Yeah.
And it was amazing. Most people said they were looking forward to reading it, but then there were certainly several people who felt the need to tell me that Aviva sure sounded like a dumb girl. And, you know, so people were prepared to, like, shame a fictional character, having not even read the book yet, you know. So.
Yeah. Well, but see, we see this all the time. And like, why the reason I thought it might have been pulled from the headlines was because we see this constantly when somebody hacked into Jennifer Lawrence's accounts and,
right.
and released photos of her in various states of undress, people blamed her for taking them. And
yes,
and there's all this
right.
advice of people saying, don't take those pictures if you don't want them to be released. And that's not just men, right? That's also...
No.
Yeah, that's also women. So how did you go about trying to craft a story that would even speak to those people? I mean, you're automatically going to speak to me, right? Obviously. Mm-hmm. But what about somebody else who would have said, hey, Jennifer Lawrence, why would you take naked pictures of yourself?
Yeah, it's amazing that even exists in that way. And obviously, you know, I'm hoping that people will lose themselves in the story itself, you know, and that they can... that they can find something to relate to. For instance, the first section of the book is about Aviva's mother, Rachel, mm-hmm. who, in trying to prevent her daughter from making a huge mistake, which is having this affair, you know, kind of ends up making everything worse. So I feel like maybe, you know, somebody reading that section has had a mother, can relate to what it is to have a mother, you know.
Yeah. Who's worried about her. I mean, it's clear she has the best intentions.
Right. And, you know, so I think in a way, if you think about scandals, they dehumanize people. You know, when we think about Monica Lewinsky, for instance, you know, you don't think about Monica Lewinsky's mother that much. So when I can write a character who's had a similar experience to Monica Lewinsky, but I can show what her family's like, what her daughter's like, you know, what she thinks, what she feels, and how difficult it is for her to move on. I hope that what I can do is, you know, give someone some empathy for a person that we consider to be a, quote, fallen woman.
That is Gabrielle Zevin, author of the new book, Young Jane Young. She'll be at the Margaret Mitchell House in Atlanta Thursday, September 14th at 7 p.m. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
And that's our show for today, but we always welcome your thoughts. We would love to hear about what you think is acceptable on social media and what we might be able to do to keep social media more courteous, more respectful, and just plain nicer. Call us and give us your ideas at 404-500-9457. You can also tweet us. The show is at OST Talk, and I'm at Celeste Headley. For today, that's On Second Thought from GPB News. Have a great day.